Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett, and before we begin the program, I do want to let you know that if any more details of this terrible shooting tragedy in Connecticut at the elementary school emerge during the program, we'll pass those along to you. And if you're listening to our 9 o'clock repeat, we'll have updates throughout the evening. Now, back here in Louisville, Mayor Greg Fisher says the city needs more revenue options to fund ambitious projects that will help it remain competitive. The mayor wants lawmakers in Frankfort to take the first step in the process that would allow the city to put temporary sales tax increases to a public vote. The mayor outlined his plan to push for the change to the state constitution to Metro Council members yesterday. Fisher says the city's general fund's not enough to keep pace with similar-sized cities, and this effort is about Louisville's independence. WFPL's political editor Philip M. Bailey covered the mayor's speech and joins us now. Hi, Philip.
Hey, Rick.
Well, first of all, let's talk about what would need to happen in order for this to happen. Lots of legislative hurdles to pass, right?
Yeah, it's not an easy task for a city in Kentucky to have a local sales tax option. First, it requires in the General Assembly a two-thirds vote in both the House, the Democratic-controlled House, and the Republican-controlled Senate. After that, it would become a statewide referendum, which all voters, not just here in Jefferson County, but throughout the state would vote on. And if approved, then it would become a constitutional amendment. That's a pretty big boulder to push up a hill. Mayor Fisher believes it's one that's worth the legislative effort, and his office is certainly trying to put pressure and pushing lawmakers, state lawmakers from the Jefferson County delegation, to get behind it. He's met with officials from across the state, including other mayors in Bowling Green and Owensboro and et cetera, to get behind this initiative. But it's certainly not an easy task that the mayor is asking for.
That brings me to my next question. Are there any state lawmakers willing to take the lead and carry the water on this next year?
There isn't someone who has stepped up and said, I'm going to introduce the legislation. I know State Representative Darrell Owens, who is the head of the delegation here in Jefferson County, has met with Mayor Fisher. Him and a group of state lawmakers have. They seem encouraged by it. They're open to the idea, because there are some issues that need to be negotiated out, which could be ironed out during the session. For example, in some cities, they get 100% back from when they open up and have a higher sales tax or they vote for one. In other places, the state gets about 20%, 10% of that. Councilman Rick Blackwell asked the mayor that question. Mayor Fisher seemed to say that please don't give the state any ideas. Because Fisher's chief argument, and I think one of his best arguments for this new initiative, which he's called LIFT, he doesn't really want to talk about it being a tax, it's called LIFT, which stands for Local Investments for Transformation. But one thing the mayor kept reiterating that both council members on the Republican and Democratic side seem to agree on, this gives Louisville more independence. It allows for the city to vote for a 1% increase to the sales tax, which his administration says could bring in $90 million annually. He says there's not enough in the general fund to do it. So the Louisville independence argument, Louisville independence from state government, seems to be an argument that was catching on amongst council members.
How's it received by the council members, his address yesterday?
There was some mixed proponents. I mean, some council Democrats seemed open to the idea. Some council Republicans seemed open to it. So there was criticism and support on both sides of the aisle. Councilwoman Mary Woolridge, for example, who's a Democrat, she made it pretty clear that she thinks that, you know, we need to come up with new ideas to raise revenue other than taxing people in this community. A sales tax is seen by some as fair because it's taxing consumption. However, others say it's a regressive tax that disproportionately affects poor or low-income people. Councilwoman Warwick is one of those people. She said that she shares the mayor's vision of Louisville being this great city and take it to the next level via the sales tax option. However, in her district, she complained about grass not being cut at vacant and abandoned properties. So there's an issue there of the general fund not being enough and basic services still lagging. Why are we going into this new idea? But some, even Councilman Kelly Downard, who initially said this was a non-starter, has said that he's open to the idea if, and this is what council Republicans keep addressing, if we're willing to cut the occupational tax or offset other taxes that residents face.
All right, we'll see what happens with the General Assembly and the Metro Council. Now, you also talked to Mayor Fisher yesterday about his future political plans.
Yes, Mayor Fisher, his name has come up as a potential challenger to Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell. I got a chance to talk to the mayor after his address before the council about this and asked him some questions on, is he even going to run for re-election for mayor?
You know, I will make a decision on that next summer. I love this job. I mean, I'm inclined to do that, but I haven't made an official decision yet. But this is a great job, great energy, and there's a lot to do.
Next summer, does that mean you're June, July period of time?
Sometime in the middle of next year.
Have you seen the PPP poll where you're trailing Mitch McConnell about 5 points?
Well, I'm not running against Mitch McConnell. I'm the mayor of Louisville, man. It's a great job.
You're not interested in running for Senate at all?
I've got a great job here. There's a lot of work to do, and I plan to do this, and hopefully more in the future. We get great feedback from people. We got a lot of work to do, and we got a great team, too.
The only reason I ask is because your counterpart in Lexington, Mayor Jim Gray, he's already announced he's running for re-election off of rumors of what he's going to run for Congress or not. But why wait so late? Why not simply say with 2 years up already that you're going to run for re-election?
Well, you notice it keeps moving back and back all the time. I'm hardly into this job 2 years, but I really enjoy it, and I'll make it an announcement at the right time. It's good for me and my family.
How do you think Mitch McConnell's doing as a senator?
Well, I tell you what everybody wants in Washington right now is they want Democrats and Republicans to come together. When you see the overwhelming majority of people in this country, they want compromise in the middle, they want more revenue, they want less spending, and I would hope Senator McConnell could be a leader in that regard.
Would you vote for him for re-election?
Oh, you got a great shirt, man.
Well, the old shirt diversion.
Yeah. The mayor loves my dress code. So you hear there, Mayor Fisher, you know, initially we were told that Mayor Fisher was going to make an official announcement on his re-election in January. Now he's saying, no, it's going to be the summer, the middle of 2013. I think it's safe to say that he has seen the poll numbers, that he and his supporters are probably encouraged by it. Let's remember that Mayor Fisher did run for the U.S. Senate back in 2008 mm-hmm. before he was mayor. In the Democratic primary, he was beaten by Bruce Lunsford. So I think it's certainly something he's thinking about and might be open to. Many people think that have considered Senator McConnell's seat to be the Louisville seat among U.S. Senate seats in Kentucky.
All right, WFPL political editor Philip M. Bailey, thanks for joining us, Philip.
Thanks, Rick.
You're listening to Byline on WFPL. Well, it happened this week in Bowling Green.
I'm extremely grateful to be given the opportunity to become Western Kentucky's head football coach. My wife, Becky, and I consider this coming home. We have children that are here in the state, and we've been here. And it's great to be able to come back to the state that we love.
That, of course, is Bobby Petrino, the new coach of the Hilltoppers. He's the former University of Arkansas football coach who was fired from that job in April for misleading officials about his relationship with a woman, not his wife, Becky. He eventually admitted to having an affair with a young woman who had also hired for a job in the football program. Petrino had been looking to get back into college coaching in recent months and was reportedly interested in the University of Kentucky job. UK instead hired Florida State defensive coordinator Mark Stoops. Petrino replaces Willie Taggart at Western. He's now the new coach at South Florida. And here to talk about all this, Petrino's hiring, and the rest of it is Chad Bishop, who covers Western Kentucky University sports for the Bowling Green Daily News. Chad, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. Well, this came as a bit of a surprise to many of us. My first inkling came the day of his hiring when you actually reported that he was on campus interviewing for the job. When did he actually first start talking with the athletic director, Todd Stewart?
You know, that's unclear. Todd Stewart said he sent out a text message to Bobby Petrino a week from today, last Friday night. But there's some indication that this may have been going on since October. I think Todd Stewart, athletic director, was pretty aware that Willie Taggart was a hot commodity, that he'd probably be leaving after the season. He's an up-and-coming coach, and Todd Stewart had a backup plan, so he went looking, and he may have started talking to Bobby Petrino way back in October, for all we know. I think there's definitely some interest on Bobby Petrino's side after he left the University of Arkansas. You know, like you said before, he wanted to get back into coaching. He has family in the state of Kentucky. I believe he has a couple of children who have attend the University of Louisville and have been attending the University of Louisville. So I think there was kind of a mutual interest that may have been going back for a couple months.
Todd Stewart, of course, well aware of the baggage, for lack of a better term, and questions about Petrino's moral character. How did he overcome those concerns?
You know, he said he termed it a lot to do with second chances. You know, he said that they sat down with Bobby Petrino. They were both forthcoming. You know, Todd Stewart, where he was coming from, and Bobby Petrino, where he was coming from. Talked a lot about those issues that went down in Arkansas. And not only that, talked about Bobby Petrino's track record of not being at a place for more than 40 years. He's a guy that likes to get on and move on and really not, you know, plant his seed, so to speak, and really, you know, take hold of a place. So Todd Stewart said that they talked about all those things over the past couple of days before they made the hire. Everybody was really honest, and he believes Bobby Petrino is ready for a second chance, and Todd Stewart said he's willing to give it to him.
Let's play another soundbite here. Bobby Petrino at the press conference where he was introduced talking about how he will sell himself, for lack of a better term, to recruits and their parents.
I'm going to be able to sit down with mom and dad and with the student athlete and make them understand how this experience has made me a better coach, a better person, and will make me understand their son better. And I'm looking forward to the opportunity that I'll be able to give student athletes when they make a mistake.
So, Chad, what's the reaction been among student athletes, members of the football team, to Petrino's hiring?
You know, they haven't come out and said it, but I get the sense they're a little, you know, unnerved, especially the underclassmen. The seniors, they have one game left. They have a bowl game. They want to go out with a win, and Bobby Petrino is not really their problem, so to speak. But, you know, the underclassmen, it's hard to tell. Just kind of reading their body language, they're not quite sure who their new coaching staff is going to be. They're not quite sure what offense and defense they're going to be in. You know, for the past 3 years, they've been under Willie Taggart, really a player's coach who they loved and were sad to see to go. So I think it's a little unnerving to them. I know a lot of them know Bobby Petrino's coaching record. I mean, he's 75-26, so they know he's a great football coach. But I think until after the bowl game, we really won't get a sense of how they truly feel about their new football coach.
And he has a 4-year contract at Western now?
That is correct, $850,000 base salary.
And what if he did? And he's been known to bolt for other jobs. He's well known here at the University of Louisville for at least interviewing for other jobs. And then he left for the NFL's Atlanta Falcons right after taking U of L to the Orange Bowl. Is there a penalty for leaving early?
Yeah, it's written into the contract. If he decides to leave, you know, on his own accord, he'll owe the school $1.2 million, which is a pretty hefty fine. So you got to think Western Kentucky will get a little bit of profit out of that if he's making $850,000 and he owes the school $1.2 million for leaving. But you know, to be honest, I really don't think that would stop him. Usually in that sort of situation, the new school that hires him would pay that sum of money, and that's what happened with Willie Taggart. He went to South Florida. He owed the school $500,000, and USF picked up the bill on that. So it's a hefty fee, but you know, I don't really think that would deter Petrino if he decides to take another job next year or 2 years from now.
Well, let's talk about this year's team coming off a great season, what a 7-5 record, I guess, under Coach Taggart, and the first real bowl appearance in many years, right?
It's the first one ever. So they've only been in the football bowl subdivision for 5 years. They used to be a 1AA team. They won a national championship in 2002. And made the transition in 2007. So this is the first one in school history. They were 7-5 last year and got snubbed, as they say, didn't get a chance to play the bowl game. But this year they're in it, and the first one in school history, and they're looking to get a win.
And who do they play?
They'll be playing Central Michigan. It's December 26th. I believe it's at 7 p.m. Central Time, 8 Eastern. It'll be on ESPN up in Detroit, Michigan, against the Central Michigan Fighting Chippewas.
All right, and the Red Towels will be flying up in Detroit. Thanks, Chad Bishop, who covers Western Kentucky University sports for the Bowling Green Daily News. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more of the program in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Howlett. New surveys from North Carolina-based Public Policy Polling show some surprising insights into Kentucky, among them the fact that U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell is the least popular member of that chamber among Kentucky voters. WFPL's Jonathan Bastian and Philip Bailey spoke with Jim Williams of Public Policy Polling about those numbers.
Jim, why don't we just start with why Kentucky right now? Why this state in your polling?
Oh, we decided to poll Kentucky. It actually won in the voting that we do on our website. We do two public polls per week in various states, and Kentucky won this week, and so we thought it would be a good opportunity to look at Senator McConnell, who has a re-election coming up.
Well, that's what we were thinking, of course. There's a lot of talk right now about McConnell, whether or not he's vulnerable right now. And so, Philip, why don't you pick up? What do the numbers look like right now for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think Public Policy Polling, which has been rated as one of the third most accurate polling firm, what they show is that Senator McConnell only has a 37% approval rating in the state. That's actually lower than President Obama's approval rating in the state, which is about 38%. It also shows that still, despite being the most unpopular U.S. senator that PPP has surveyed, he still leads his Democratic opponents by 4 points. Actress Ashley Judd, Secretary of State Alison Lindgren Grimes, even Lieutenant Governor and former Louisville Mayor Jerry Abramson. He leads current Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher by 5 points. So despite McConnell's unpopularity, he still seems to have a pretty dominant control of the ring thus far in 2014, but there's a lot of time left.
And Jim, are these numbers surprising to you at all when you began to get the data back?
A little bit, but not really when you think about it. Senator McConnell's profile is nationally is so closely identified with your congressional leadership. And as we know, congressional popularity is at historical lows right now. So I think even voters in his own state are associating him with, lack of progress on the congressional level. And that's probably something that's hurting him, and even in his home state.
And I would say Senator McConnell is obviously the one person who was associated more than any other Republican when he made those comments in 2010 that his chief goal was to make President Obama a one-term president. That, along with the serious questions about filibuster reform and the stalemate in the Senate, I think Mr. Williams is exactly right. McConnell is probably the most high-profile person who has gotten a lot of darts and arrows thrown at him, just as much as the president. I think what is also surprising, and Mr. Williams probably can speak to this better, is that the polling also found Senator McConnell has problems within his own party. He only has a 59% approval rating amongst Republicans, which I believe is pretty low for an incumbent among his own party. Also, among Republican primary voters, only about 35% say they want a candidate more conservative than McConnell. Now, we've done stories, Jonathan, in the past on Senator McConnell's relationship with the Tea Party and his other colleague, Senator Rand Paul. There doesn't appear to be a Tea Party candidate running against McConnell in a primary. He's done a great job at stiff-arming that. But there still is anxiety and a question of, is McConnell McConnell conservative enough amongst his own base?
Right. Jim, let's look at some of the people you have potentially running against McConnell here. And you know the numbers yourself here, but it looks like Ashley Judd right now would be one of the main contenders.
Yeah, Ashley Judd actually is the preferred choice of Democratic primary voters right now. She comes in at 29% among Democratic primary voters who have an opinion on who they might want to see run against Mitch McConnell, followed by Jerry Abramson at 16 and Jack Conway at 15 and another 15% undecided. So that field is pretty unformed at the moment, but Ashley Judd is benefiting from her name recognition at this point, I think.
That's Jim Williams of Public Policy Polling talking to us about the major political finding of his survey of Kentucky voters, a PPP survey of Kentucky voters. The group also did some polling on matters of lesser gravity, shall we say, but no less interesting. And here to talk about those is WFPL's online managing editor, Joseph Lord. Hey, Joe.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
Fine. Thank you. So this outfit also surveyed Kentuckians about some sports matters and other matters, right?
Right. So they asked Kentuckians, or registered voters in Kentucky, what they thought about the University of Louisville's move to the Atlantic Coast Conference. What they found was maybe surprising that 53% of people had no opinion whatsoever, where 36% approved, and then there was 11% who didn't approve at all.
And also, there was an NFL question, right?
There was an NFL question, and this one is surprising, perhaps. 25% of Kentuckians identified themselves as Bengals fans. You would think around here the Colts would be maybe number one. Yeah. They've had a lot of success in recent years. They came in with 9%, under both the Cowboys and the Packers, too, so...
And back to college basketball, yeah. There was a comparison question, Calipari versus Pitino.
Yes, John Calipari has higher favorability ratings than Rick Pitino. 49% have a favorable opinion of John Calipari, whereas 44% have a favorable opinion of Rick Pitino. There's a lot of history there, obviously. And also, it bears noting that 17% of Kentuckians identify themselves as Louisville fans, whereas 66% identify themselves as Kentucky fans. So that probably explains a little bit of that.
Got about 30 seconds left. Sure. There was a bourbon comparison, or well, I should say whiskey comparison.
Whiskey comparison, yeah. And this maybe says something about PPP being a North Carolina group, but they say 20% of Kentuckians prefer Jim Beam, 18% prefer Jack Daniels. 61% have no preference. I'm assuming that they have another bourbon of choice.
Well, those are the only choices given, right?
Right, exactly. Those are only two choices.
My write-in vote is for Elijah Craig. But, I'm from Bardstown, Kentucky. Well, we have some limited knowledge about both the production and consumption.
There you go.
Joseph Lord is WFPL's online managing editor. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Byline on WFPL. The downtown portion of the Ohio River Bridges Project will add many more lanes of interstate highway to Louisville City Center. Supporters say this is progress. Opponents say it's devastation. Either way, it's perhaps the largest infrastructure project in Louisville since the highways were first built four decades ago. For a look at how the highways were first constructed, WFPL's Gabe Bullard produced this oral history. We'll be hearing from Tom Owen, a Metro councilman, historian, and archivist, Carl Kramer, an urban historian, professor, and head of the Institute for Local and Oral History at Indiana University Southeast, and Brandon Klayko, editor of the blog Broken Sidewalk.
Well, of course, it was a largely an industrial city, a heavy industry.
The one word that comes to mind is contiguous, and that is streetscapes were consistent.
The center of downtown was 4th and Broadway, and Main Street and the riverfront were largely backwater, if you will.
The waterfront in downtown Louisville, we had a history of abandonment. Our intense industrial use, if you had gotten off the Belle of Louisville in 1947 or 49, you would have seen a jumble of brick buildings and various forms of decline.
The city was also experiencing considerable suburban growth during the years after World War II.
We came out of World War II smelling like a rose, economically and industrially king on the hill. Family may or may not have had an automobile, and in many cases, increasing numbers did have an automobile.
They saw the benefits that the war had brought in terms of economic development, and they wanted to sustain those developments. And the highway and other transportation improvements were very much a part. The original plan for I-64 was to bring it across the Ohio River through southern Indiana. Community leaders at that time saw that we can't have I-64 going over into Indiana.
The interstate on the waterfront, with its exits, pushed hotels, pushed arenas, pushed museums toward the north rather than toward the south end of downtown. And so now we struggle with what it means to have a downtown that still goes to Broadway, and how to revitalize it, and how to create densities and synergies and activities.
One of the important stories for the North-South Expressway, which then became I-65, was that, of course, that it came through the center of the city. The original plan was that it would come to the Clark Memorial Bridge. The Central Kentucky chapter of the American Institute of Architects said the expressway coming down 2nd Street or through the heart of downtown, that we would just divide downtown into two. It was about that time the proposal came up to swing the expressway east toward Campbell Street and cut across the river there. That plan was finally adopted, and of course that became the Kennedy Bridge.
If you look at where the highway turns around Hospital Curve and then winds its way over to the Kennedy Bridge, the diagonal highway running through the grid, that really is about the most destructive thing you could do, because it clears a larger swath of land.
You're talking about clearing for interstate highways. Well, then just add a second dimension, the clearing for urban renewal. Just massive clearing of downtown, near downtown sites, the two in combination totally rearranged the streetscape.
You can look at historic aerial views of the city and see that there is nothing left.
When you build a mountain, I-65, it is on an earthen mountain. When you do that, you are building a wall, a psychological wall that divides neighborhoods. But go to Market Street or Jefferson Street in downtown, and the underpasses on Market Street under I-65, underpasses under on Jefferson Street under 65, no one denies that psychologically the center city, the downtown, is separated from the Health Sciences Center. It is a barrier. It is a significant barrier. It is an isolation. It is a desolation. It is a dullness. It is not the contiguous urban streetscape. And it was done without any sensitivity to this issue.
One of the things you hear people say was, how could they have built Spaghetti Junction that way, or that was bad design? And I say, no, it's not a matter of bad design, because Spaghetti Junction was never designed. It was just built.
Do you think that could be a problem with the new project if the interstate is widened through downtown?
It's really going to further separate what's going on in East Market Street and Nulu and what's going on in the eastern part of downtown around Slugger Field. And if somebody's going downtown to experience, you know, vibrant street life, they're not going to be sitting on a street cafe underneath a highway or in the shadow of a highway. It's not what you think of when you think of a vibrant downtown. If you can bring activity up on each side, the more activity you have there, the less you're going to notice the highway. But as it stands, we're losing potential activity, and it's going to make its presence felt even more, the highway.
Our city right now is on the cusp of spending $13 million. What are we doing with that money? We are building pedestrian-oriented infrastructure underneath the underpasses on Market Street, connecting the Nulu District with the city center west toward downtown.
It's a question of, in the long term, of trade-offs. What do you give up in order to get something better? And people are going to disagree what those comparative benefits are. When I was executive director of the Park County Planning Commission, I was certainly the first person in Indiana who looked at the data and said, the data justifies a downtown bridge. Change is a constant in urban life. One thing I can be absolutely assured of is that 30 or 40 or 50 years after, the people are going to say, they're crazy. Why did they do that? And they will be right. I'm equally certain, based upon experience, that every time you do something like that, they're right. Because needs change. You respond to needs at the time and the future as you understand. If you don't, nothing happens.
I'm not sure that interstate madness has gone away in major cities of America. I would like to think it has, and I would like to think that America can return to a model where we don't depend on the automobile, either lowered or raised above the streetscape. That's the interstate model. But I think the automobile for the foreseeable future is going to be the American experience.
This oral history was produced by Gabe Bullard. The music is by Grape. This is Byline on WFPL. Is Kentucky a northern or southern state? It's a question that's been debated since before the Civil War. Mary Jean Wall decided to re-examine this question in her new book. Her ultimate answer is reflected in the title, How Kentucky Became Southern, a tale of outlaws, horse thieves, gamblers, and breeders. According to Wall, Kentucky's southernness is directly tied to the horse business, which exploded after the Civil War. She spoke with WFPL's Jonathan Bastian.
Well, the narrative was being created both without and within the region. And at this time, let's say the late 1800s, it's becoming very popular for the South to almost rise again in people's imaginations and for all things Southern to be embraced again. We were seeing this happening in literature, in stage plays, and in reunions of Civil War veterans from both sides because they want to keep memory alive. And then in the literature, they're just romanticizing the old antebellum South. So this has become a popular phenomenon. This is when a lot of your Civil War statues go up in throughout the South on courthouse lawns was the late 1800s as the daughters of the Confederacy are trying to establish this notion that the South was a proud place. At the same time, up in the North, when I say North, I mean mostly the Northeast, like New York, New Jersey, places like that. There's a lot of angst up there at the time. There are labor strikes in factories, and these strikes are very bloody. So if you're an industrialist and you own a factory or a series of factories, you're facing a lot of problems. So what better time to embrace this seemingly or increasingly popular notion of this romanticized South, and Kentucky being the nearest antebellum former slavery type state with its horse country could be made into this old South in people's imaginations. We call it the Near South. It was easier to get to than going down to Georgia or Alabama, something like that. And the people that had horses start looking here as a place that perhaps they went into denial about the violence. It was still going on, but this antebellum romance that was becoming very pervasive in society, these rich people could buy that romance. They could live it where others could only read about it. So they start buying horse farmland, moving their operations here.
What then would inspire, say, the great barons of the Northeast that had so much money, they had their horses in upstate New York or New Jersey? Why would they want to consider going into business in Kentucky? Did they have an interest in portraying this Southern attitude that you write about?
I think they did. I think they finally came around to wanting to become Southern. It was a bit of an escape for them, as I've seen that they had so much to worry about in their wealthy lives. If they were industrialists, their factories could just go up in riots because the labor issues were so intense at the time. And there were a lot of other problems throughout business at that time. And there was a depression in 1893 that took about 7 years for the country to fully recover from. So they needed an escape, just like the average Joe on the street needed an escape. But they could afford to buy this very expensive lifestyle escape here, purchasing the antebellum South. Think about it. They could purchase this myth. They could purchase a dream. They could have their horses down here. They could come to visit them once or twice a year and imagine they were squire of an old Terra-type plantation. And that's a very compelling mythology to people. It always has been, and they could purchase, they could buy into this. So it was an escape from life in a way. They had known all along that this country down here was good for raising horses, but they ignored that and raised their horses up in the Northeast because it was so violent here. Well, at some point when that Southern notion begins to grip the country and it's hugely popular, then they go into denial about the violence that had kept them away. Okay, we'll raise our horses down there. And you can see articles in the sporting periodicals at the time, well, Mr. Belmont realized, after all, that you cannot raise a good horse on Long Island, so he's come down to Kentucky. But when his manager, his farm manager, came to Kentucky to set up this farm called the Nursery Stud here, he arrived with pistols strapped all over his body, and he said he was afraid. So
There you have it.
Yeah. Would this have existed, though, if Kentucky pre-Civil War had nothing to do with horses?
Well, a lot of horses, thoroughbreds, were bred throughout the South before the Civil War. You had breeding going on in Alabama, in Louisiana, Tennessee, certainly. And then around the turn of the century, you saw Tennessee's once major horse breeding operation down there begin to fall apart because Tennessee outlawed betting. So when you don't have horse racing, it's pretty hard to have breeding operations also. So Kentucky, in a way, inherited it from Tennessee for sure at that point, but Kentucky was the near South in people's minds. You could get here much easier than you could get to Alabama or Louisiana. So Kentucky ends up the last man standing.
Mary Jean Wall is the author of How Kentucky Became Southern, a tale of outlaws, horse thieves, gamblers, and breeders. She spoke with WFPL's Jonathan Bastian. Before we take a break, a program note, please join us next week for a discussion about the effort to bring an NBA team to Louisville and opposition to the idea. We'll hear the arguments and discuss the role of the University of Louisville in all this. The Cards basketball teams, of course, are the Yum Center's primary tenants, KFC Yum Center's primary tenants. That's a news special on bringing an NBA team to Louisville next Tuesday at 1 here on WFPL. And we'll be back with more of this program in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Howlett, and it is time for our art segment, and Aaron Keene is here with us. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Rick.
Things are a little tempered this afternoon and this evening with the terrible tragedy in Connecticut, but we will press on with, first of all, we have a guest here, but first of all, we have a few things going on this weekend that are holiday related, and let's start with the Kings of Christmas, which is opening at the Bardstown. What's
it
that?
It opened last night. It's an original holiday comedy about a wacky, dysfunctional family and the one sort of so-called normal son who comes home and completely loses it on his family one Christmas. So it's a little bit of an homage to A Christmas Carol in that we get some wacky spirits who take him through his Christmases past and present. And of course, it's a holiday play. So in the end, he is, spoiler alert, he regains his Christmas spirit and all is well. But there's an Elvis impersonating magician. There's a dead cat named Marley. There are a lot of silly puns and wacky idiot brother antics. So it's a little bit of a Christmas play for folks who can appreciate a good old-fashioned dysfunctional family.
And tonight, am I saying this correct, is the Inky Reading Series?
Yes, the Inky Reading Series is a monthly live literary event. It happens at the Bardstown. So that's downstairs while the play is upstairs. They have two different venue spaces. And this month, they have Rodney Whitwer, a poet from Boston, whose first book, Gone and Gone, just came out from Red Hand Press, great little literary press in Los Angeles. And Margaret McMullen, who is a novelist, In My Mother's House was a Penn Faulkner nominee. She teaches at the University of Evansville. But they also have a special guest this month. The Squalus Puppeteers are going to be at Inky. So I don't know if the puppets are actually acting out poems, but we can hope. And maybe you have to show up tonight to find out.
And finally, tomorrow, Saturday, the $20 art show at Art Sanctuary.
Yeah, Art Sanctuary has a pretty cool new space on Shelby Street in Schnitzelburg, and they are welcoming the $20 art show. And this is an annual event that a lot of interesting visual artists in town take part in. It's not sort of an open door, so there's hurdles to admission to be in. So it's lots of quality work. And the whole point of it is to bring smaller pieces in or prints, things that can be sold for $20 or less. So folks who still have holiday shopping to do and want to buy original art, maybe start someone's art collection off for them, you can do so in an affordable way. It's local artists supporting local art and see some really neat stuff there. So that happens on Saturday.
You're listening to Byline on WFPL, and a program note before we carry on, NPR will have a special coverage now at 2 p.m. On this terrible shooting tragedy at the elementary school in Connecticut, where there are numerous casualties. Again, NPR will have a special coverage coming up at 2 o'clock this afternoon. And of course, if you're listening to our 9 o'clock repeat, we'll have coverage throughout the evening. Now back to Byline and our arts segment with Erin Keene. You have a special guest with you from the Louisville Ballet.
I do. I'm here with Christy Corbett Miller.
Hello.
Hi, Christy. Christy's a member of the Louisville Ballet Company. And this year, you are dancing the role of the Sugar Plum Fairy in the Nutcracker.
Yes. Yes. The 10th year.
The 10th year.
Yes.
As the Sugar Plum Fairy?
Absolutely. My 10th season here and my 10th year as the Sugar Plum Fairy here.
Wow. Do you get recognized in the grocery store?
Sadly, no. I've been recognized a few times, but not as much as I would like.
So you've been, so how long have you been dancing the Nutcracker? I think most do we say ballerinas, ballet dancers? Most dancers grow up dancing
Absolutely.
The Nutcracker. You're a mouse, you're a soldier, you kind of work your way up in height up to the starring role, right? How long have you been doing the ballet in general?
I think I was in probably third or fourth grade, my first Nutcracker, starting out as an angel.
An angel.
Working my way up.
And so in the Louisville Ballet, I believe more than 40 young dancers in each production, and it's double cast because of school matinees.
Yes.
So how is that different for a dancer to be on stage with that many developing artists, not just you and your full company of pros?
Actually, it is. For me, it's wonderful. It's one of my favorite things. Before the curtain goes up on Act Two, they line the angels up in the wings. This is something I've never told anyone that I do. I'm spilling all my secrets today. And, you know, I always have some jitters and nerves when I'm about to go be the Sugar Plum Fairy. It's, you know, it's, I want to live up to everything. But what calms me down the most is before the angels make their entrance, I walk down the line and say hello and make eye contact with each and every one of them in my tutu and tiara, because it reminds me they look at all of us, all of the adults, not just the Sugar Plum Fairy, with such wonder. And this is why we're doing the Nutcracker, for that magic that we're creating. And so it helps calm me down right before I walk on stage to remind myself that this is what's important. And you go out there and you do your best.
Well, live performances always have a lot of opportunity for unexpected turns. I imagine a production that has lots of kids in it also sort of doubles that. Any moments stand out over the last 10, 13 years or so?
A few years ago in the Louisville Ballet's previous production of The Nutcracker, the angels also started off, however, one of them got a little nervous and forgot to go to the restroom before they made their entrance.
Oh, no.
And left a little something on the stage for us. Bless her heart.
Oh, wow.
So, like you said, it's live. And funnily enough, that's the second time in my Sugar Plum career that has happened. It happened in Texas as well.
Well, someday when that little angel or chef is also the Sugar Plum Fairy in some other company's production,
that's
she
right.
can offer that up in her own radio interview and maybe
own it.
Look back on it and laugh.
I love it. Right.
Well, so this is the 2009 was the first year that Val Canaparoli's The Brown Foreman Nutcracker opened here at the Louisville Ballet.
Yeah.
And so what are some of the particular challenges of taking a ballet that you've known very well and then restaging it completely?
Well, what's wonderful about doing a new production is it almost makes you hear music that you have listened to almost your entire life completely differently, because the steps are different and perhaps the interpretation of the music is different. What one choreographer might hear is completely different from someone else or yourself. And so it's wonderful. It makes you listen to something that might become old or tired in a new way and keeps it fresh and exciting.
Yeah, I think, you know, people think of the Nutcracker, they think of a sort of a static thing. This is the Nutcracker. It looks the same everywhere. But of course, it doesn't. Different choreographers interpret the story and the music in different ways, like you said.
Yeah.
And so even if you haven't been to see the Nutcracker in a few years, that production that you saw growing up isn't at all the same production that's on stage right now.
No. And ours is lush and colorful and vivid. And it's fun to sit in the audience and take it all in. Definitely.
So do you only dance the Sugar Plum Fairy, or do you do different roles in this production?
I have different roles as well. I also dance the part of Marie, and I am the rose in the Waltz of the Flowers. And this year, I am a snowflake as well.
Wow! So you guys are really versatile. Is that difficult to? I mean, I think about in the theater, for example, or in the orchestra, you play the oboe, you play the oboe.
Right.
If you're playing Scrooge in A Christmas Carol, you're Scrooge through the most of the run. But is that difficult to switch up roles like that for you?
No, I think we're all so accustomed to it. You know, you get used to thinking on your feet, and a different piece of music is a different role. So it's difficult to confuse those, you know, choreographically. That tends not to happen.
Okay.
Confusion in that way. You know, we're so accustomed to it, and it definitely makes it more exciting. I think we would all get tired of doing the same part every, you know, 18 performances and only doing the same thing every show. So it's wonderful that we are able to share the roles and do different things.
Right. So if you're a Christie fan, you can come back a different day and see her dance different roles.
Please
too.
Do.
All of them. So you're dancing the part of Marie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Indulge me here. This is something that I've had, that I've been trying to tease out for a while now. Marie or Clara? What's
you know,
the deal?
Actually, it is what I have heard. Originally, the character is Marie. Now, I think that the Clara name came from a doll that Marie was given. I think that is where the Clara came from. And somehow, different interpretations called the young girl Clara rather than Marie. That, and I might have to check my facts on that. Good question.
Well,
wow.
I mean, I've been wondering about this because when you're doing research on the Nutcracker, what you hear
yes.
lots of Clara seems to be the name, and that's the you oftentimes the name of the character of the little girl whose Nutcracker comes
yes.
to life and is sort of the central the dreamer of this big fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of the heart of the show. But then you start hearing Marie pop up a little bit again. And I thought, well, is that a bit of an old fashioned, the original, and now it's Clara. But Bruce says Marie in this production,
yes,
you're Marie.
Absolutely.
So.
Absolutely. I do think it is a more traditional original story name.
Did you, when you were growing up, was it always Clara?
I played Clara.
You played Clara.
As a young girl, yes.
I find that so interesting. I wonder if there are camps out there in
go
ballet
Marie,
world.
Go Clara.
Yeah, Team Clara, Team Marie. Can we do t-shirts next year? Maybe? Well, so you working with a lot of little kids in this production, mm-hmm. but you recently became a mother yourself.
I did, 8 months ago.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And
yes.
you're already back.
I am.
did you take any time off?
Oh, yes. Oh, I had to. Oh, yes. She was born April 1st, and we started back mid-August. So I was able to have a couple of months to get my feet underneath me and slowly come back, and very
wow.
slowly.
But that's a really physically demanding job that you have. I think that's amazing that you've been able to rejoin the company so soon.
Oh, well, I had a lot of wonderful women in the company pave the way for me. We have quite a few mothers in the company that have all bounced back so beautifully. I thought, oh goodness, I have to live up to this.
Well, there's a lot of course, you know, a big national conversation right now is having it all. Can women be mothers and be at the top of their game professionally?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being in one of the lead roles in a professional dance production is pretty high up on the career ladder. How do you balance such a physically demanding career with being a new mom?
As soon as the baby goes to sleep, I go to sleep.
Yeah.
No, it's every day is a lesson. Every day I feel like I fail in some way or try to learn how to make the next day better. And mm-hmm. in trying to have it all and trying to take care of myself, certainly I can't be as selfish with my time in Nutcracker as I used to be, taking care of my body or eating well or so, because my first priority is her. And but it's been wonderful. My time management skills have improved vastly.
I can imagine.
And I have a wonderful husband that helps. I don't know what I would do without him because he makes sure that food is on the table and that when I am in the theater late, there's no trouble. He gives her a bath and puts her to bed and everything's great. So I don't have to worry about her when I'm at the theater, okay. which is wonderful. I can go to the theater and be the ballerina and thanks to him.
Congrats to the three of you on your new family.
You, thank you.
And so you've been here in Louisville for a decade
mm-hmm.
then.
Yes.
And what keeps you here rather than moving on?
Well, I said to Kara in the car, what keeps anyone here? Anyone that lives here knows. I think this is a fantastic town. It's got everything you would need in a big city without all the hassles. I grew up outside of Atlanta, and mm-hmm. I don't miss it. It's a wonderful city, but it takes an hour to get anywhere. You know, and we're so spoiled here. We have everything that other huge towns have to offer, I think, and the charm of a small town and friendly people and a beautiful geography and topography.
And a professional dance company.
So, that I love.
Yeah. Well, Christy, we're looking forward to seeing you dance the role of the Sugar Plum Fairy this season, and also the Rose in the Waltz of the Flowers, and also Marie, not Clara. Let's get it straight.
Wonderful. Please come to all three.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Thanks to Aaron Keene and Christy Corbett-Miller from the Louisville Ballet. Again, a program note, we will have an update from NPR coming up at the top of the hour on the latest on that terrible shooting at a Connecticut elementary school. That's all the time we have for today's Byline program. Byline is produced by the WFPL News staff. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Hellett. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.